This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Newslink.
Hello, welcome to Newslink. I'm Matt Herman in Bonn, Germany. Coming up in the program, we'll hear what European economic policymakers have been discussing and what's being called a moment of truth for the euro ahead of a summit this weekend. We'll hear that the so-called 99% aren't just occupying Wall Street these days. The movement has spread to Frankfurt, Lisbon, London.
I believe the 1% who rule this country and world don't represent the 99%'s interests. Everything that they're doing at the moment is vested in increasing their wealth.
And we'll find out how those protests turned violent in Rome. All that and more coming up on Newslink here on Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster. Let's get started. The countdown to restore confidence in the euro has begun. European leaders are under pressure to come up with a grand plan of action to tackle the eurozone debt crisis in time for their summit on Sunday. The aim is to prevent the debt crisis from triggering a financial meltdown. But can Europe's leaders really deliver? Vanessa Mock takes a look.
Greece is where the eurozone's crisis started, and 18 months later, the country's fate is in the balance. The Greeks are continuing to protest and strike against cuts to pensions, tax rises and job losses. The government says it's pulled out all the stops to get its finances in order, but that's unlikely to be enough. Sonny Kapoor is from the Redefine Economics Consultancy.
Greece cannot get out of the mess it's in without seriously reducing its debt stock, which means that there is going to be a default. Now, an orderly default is much more preferable compared to a disorderly one.
A Greek default may be just weeks away, and now the groundwork is being laid to prevent all-out mayhem. Investors and banks would take a hit. The Franco-Belgian bank Dexia has already unravelled. But the worry is that a Greek default could be just the tip of the iceberg.
The direct exposure is not that large, would be manageable and, you know, could be recapitalized.
Guntram Wolf is an economist with Bruegel, a think tank in Brussels.
Now, of course, the more difficult question is what happens if financial markets take this as a signal that there will be similar forms of restructuring in other eurozone peripheries, in particular in Italy.
Italy is the eurozone's third largest economy and faces a debt mountain of 1.9 trillion euros. If it fails, there wouldn't be enough cash to bail it out, and it could bring down scores of banks that hold its debt. That's why banks' defences must be shored up, says José Manuel Barroso, the European Commission president.
And we need to fix the sovereign debt problem, which can only be done through a coherent package. And we must therefore urgently strengthen the banks, because in fact those two issues, the sovereign contagion and the banks, are now, whether we like it or not, linked.
EU leaders now have to agree on how to recapitalise their banks and boost the eurozone's bailout fund to somewhere in the region of 2 trillion euros. The head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, says European leaders must deliver this time around.
The key priority at this point in time is for the members of the eurozone and the Europeans in general to address the overall complex issues.
Markets have rallied in the past week on the hopes of a fix-all solution, but the eurozone's woes are deep-seated. A new fiscal union to tie the 17 economies together has yet to be built, and every step will have to be squared with increasingly reticent national parliaments. And that could take years. Vanessa Mock, Deutsche Welle Radio, Brussels.
Among the quicker, simpler options that have been put forward to get Greece back to a manageable level of debt would be a so-called haircut. That would entail the country's creditors agreeing to take a hit, giving up their claim on perhaps as much as 50 or 60% of what Greece owes them. The banks take a hit, Greece gets back on track to pay off its debts. I asked Tom Kirschmeier, an economist at the London School of Economics, what's not to like?
Well, you know, I think the problem is a much bigger one, because the crisis is essentially a political crisis and not purely an economic crisis. Because what we've learned in the process is that the institutions we have in Europe are not adequate for the job of governing a common currency. So I think the founding fathers of the euro were probably over-optimistic in how strong their own institutions are and what can be delivered in multilateral treaties. But what we know now is that we probably need common institutions that are common for the Eurozone, similar to the US, that can govern the key economic indicators of the Eurozone.
Well, how are you going to get the various countries of Europe, or even of the Eurozone, to agree to something like that? Because a country that has to sort of submit its financial fate to another country is going to feel a bit disempowered, shall we say.
It's a very good question, and it's obviously a very tricky process. But what I suspect we will end up one day, and this will not happen overnight, is actually something of a United States of Europe. So you have one fiscal policy, and then the individual states are allowed to operate within that framework, but are not allowed to actually borrow money anymore in the long run. What we have to do now is actually kind of commit ourselves credibly that this is something that will happen, and then the pressure of the market on the individual countries will ease almost immediately.
But how do we get there from here? Because the idea of a United States of Europe where every country's financial fate is tied together is pretty profoundly unappealing to a lot of the citizens of Europe. There's a lot of demonizing going on in the press and also among certain political parties all across Europe.
Well, I agree, and one of the big problem is that we haven't explained to our electorate what is actually a common currency, what it entails, and what needs to be done with it. And it was never properly explained. That doesn't mean that we don't need these institutions. It means we have to explain to our electorate exactly what is going on and the benefits of it. And also we have to keep in mind that there is no going back. I think the idea that we can unravel a common currency amongst very developed capital-intensive states is impossible. So, if we unravel it and if each country would decide to go their own way, it would mean the end of the European Union as it is.
Tom Kirschmeier of the London School of Economics there. And, not far down the road from the LSE, the Occupy London protests, inspired by those taking place on Wall Street in New York, have entered their third day, with more than 400 people camped out at St. Paul's Cathedral in the British capital's financial district. The organizers say that they plan to stay until mid-December, despite appeals from the police for them to leave. On Saturday, as many as 4,000 people joined the anti-capitalist rally, denouncing what they describe as a too-cozy relationship between government and wealthy financiers. Nick Martin reports.
Monday morning, and the protesters have come into contact with the regular weekday inhabitants of the British capital's financial district. The many thousands of people who work in the City of London arrived to find more than 100 tents at the foot of the steps of St. Paul's Cathedral. But there's been no confrontation, only bemused stares and support from perhaps an unlikely place. Rather than asking those camped out to leave, the cathedral's Canon Chancellor, Reverend Charles Fraser, requested that instead London's Metropolitan Police step down.
We are the 99%! We are the 99%!
Taking their lead from the Occupy Wall Street movement, the protesters' original plan on Saturday was to invade Paternoster Square, the home of the London Stock Exchange. But the property and land around the plaza, which is also UK head office of investment bank Goldman Sachs, is private property. On Friday, the owners went to court to prevent a permanent camp being set up. Police on horseback prevented the crowd from entering the square, so the protesters moved to the steps of St Paul's, one of London's most famous landmarks.
I believe the 1% who rule this country and world don't represent the 99%'s interests. Everything that they're doing at the moment is vested in increasing their wealth, and it's driven by their greed and not the interests of the welfare of the people.
Londoner Edward there, who didn't want to give his full name. He summed up the feeling of many of the protesters. The words corporate and greed was mentioned in the same sentence by many of the people I spoke to. A number of the demonstrators are out of work or graduates waiting for their first job. They say they've been directly impacted by the effects of the bank bailouts.
Because I am the 1 in 10 unemployed. I've recently retrained to get a job in the marketplace, and with all the cuts, I'm unable to get a job. So it's left me in a really bad situation.
Londoner Ash Phipps, who's struggling to get work as an English teacher. And many of those at the rally claim that capitalism has failed. Naomi Byron, who works part-time for Britain's ultra-left-wing Socialist Party, wants to see programmes like the National Health Service expanded, not scaled back.
I'm against the cuts. I don't think they're necessary. You look at after the Second World War, we were in just as big a financial crisis. But actually, we set up the NHS, we developed industry. Here, we're being asked to pay for the bankers' crisis. And actually, it was their fault. It wasn't ordinary people's.
WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange addressed the protesters on the steps of St Paul's. The Australian activist, who's fighting extradition over rape allegations in Sweden, said he wanted to show solidarity with the Occupy movement. Assange claimed that more than any other organisations, international banking groups have tried to silence the whistleblowing website.
Why is it that banks have so much to hide? Why is it that banks, even more than military and intelligence organisations, have attacked WikiLeaks? Because banks are all about secrecy. Banks are all about asset hiding, hiding the ill-gotten gains of rich individuals from around the world, stashing them in the Cayman Islands, other offshore jurisdictions, and yes, in London.
There were just a handful of arrests on Saturday and none since. The spokesperson for London Mayor Boris Johnson said he supported the right to peaceful protests and was pleased that the demonstration had largely been calm. Scotland Yard said they have a good flow of communication with the organisers, who are keen not to be associated with the summer riots, which blighted many British cities. Paul Obertelli from Croydon says their sit-in will be peaceful.
What doesn't help is there's been scenes a few weeks ago where there's been some riots and violence, and I think it's important people don't get confused with protesting to rioting, because they're completely two different things, and I think the media would like to blend the two together to discourage people from coming out and doing this and that today.
After the weekend demonstration, the real sit-in has begun. The protesters are holding daily meetings to decide their next plan of action and are issuing joint statements on the Occupy London website. Organisers say they'll aim to stay until Christmas, but the owners of the shops around the area, many of whom have had to stay shut for 2 days, may think differently. Nick Martin, Deutsche Welle Radio, London.
Occupy Wall Street-inspired protests are taking place all over Europe, in Frankfurt, in Lisbon, in Zurich, mostly without violent incident. Italy's were different. Tens of thousands of protesters were marching in Rome when a fringe group of young men began setting cars on fire and smashing windows. As Megan Williams reports, the violent ending was a painful disappointment for the protesters, one that raises questions about who it was that ruined the day.
The protest began with music blaring and people holding placards and dancing in the afternoon sunshine. More than 100,000, mostly young Italians, turned out on the cobblestone streets of Rome. There, like this 50-year-old small businessman, to express his indignation at corporate and government greed.
Our young people don't have a future. And this way of in which politics and these systems just thinks about profits. And there is no way, besides doing this, making this voice, this young people's voice loud to change the things. This is why I'm here.
This high school student said he and his friends want
some alternative to this government that don't understand us, that when we're protesting, they don't consider us, and when there's violence in the protests, they only look at the people who are hitting policemen and not at our ideas.
It was a prescient comment. Soon after, organized groups of young men wearing black face masks and carrying bats began smashing store and bank windows and set alight several cars and a police van. In one incident that was played repeatedly on Italian television, a group broke into a church, pulled out a ceramic Madonna, and smashed it on the street outside. Police used tear gas and water cannons to disperse them, but not before more than 100 officers and dozens of protesters were injured. Damage has been tallied at well over €1 million. This weekend's protest isn't the first to turn violent at the hands of an organized fringe group. Members of what's been called the Black Bloc recently infiltrated protests against the construction of high-speed rail lines in northern Italy. 12 were arrested this weekend, and a profile of the violent group is emerging. An estimated 800 were present at the Rome March, forming two distinct groups and working in smaller units of 20 or so. They threw smoke bombs, bottles, and bricks. Black Bloc members come from all parts of Italy, are between ages 17 and 25, and are well-trained. One young member who spoke anonymously to the Italian paper La Repubblica said he and others were trained in Greece. Italy's interior minister plans to propose new legislation to crack down on the violent group. But many observers, such as the center-left La Repubblica newspaper editor Mauro Ezio, fear that the real non-violent message of the marchers has already been lost.
Nella violenza non c'è nessuna ragione. E anzi, c'è in qualche modo...
Namely, that Italy's government, led by Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, needs to pay attention to the despair of the younger generation, who, with lack of jobs and prospects, see little future here. Megan Williams, Deutsche Welle Radio, Rome.
Around the world, around the clock, news and information from the heart of Europe. On DWTV, Deutsche Welle Radio, and online too at dwworld.de. This is Newslink. I'm your host, Matt Herman. The German president, Christian Wolff, continued his official visit to Afghanistan on Monday, the first by a German president to the country in 44 years. Wolff met with Afghan leader Hamid Karzai on the weekend before traveling north to Mazar-e-Sharif in Kunduz, where he paid homage to the German soldiers who lost their lives during the 10-year Afghanistan war. Darren Marr has this report.
It wasn't until Sunday evening that Christian Wolff could take off his tie. He attended a barbecue with military personnel at the Afghan headquarters of the Bundeswehr, Germany's armed forces, in the northern city of Mazar-e-Sharif. Together, Wolff and the soldiers sat discussing the successes and failures of the war, hearing praise and criticism. Wolff told the soldiers they could be proud of their efforts in Afghanistan.
The soldiers are the first-class visiting card for our country. In this country, you'll find much recognition of this. It has been confirmed to me by all participating departments and elements.
From Mazar-e-Sharif, Wolff traveled to Kunduz to visit more German soldiers and aid workers. On the first day of his trip, the German president held talks with his Afghan counterpart, Hamid Karzai, in the capital, Kabul. Wolff's predecessor, Horst Köhler, came to this country just to visit the soldiers, but this German president wanted to make this a state occasion, including a meeting at the presidential palace. The last visit of this kind was 44 years ago, when President Heinrich Lübke travelled to Kabul in 1967. But this time around, the visit was not intended as a mere courtesy call. President Christian Wolff came to Kabul with a political message.
The most important signal that I want to send during my trip is to the Afghan people that they look to Germany as a friend and as a reliable long-term partner.
What Wolff wanted to sell essentially was the idea of a partnership beyond 2014, by which time international troops in the country should have been gradually withdrawn. Well, at least that's the plan. Germany, too, wants to bring home its roughly 5,000 soldiers and other personnel, with the first to be withdrawn this year. Wolff told the Afghans that Germany would then intensify its efforts to help train Afghan soldiers and police. Whether the Afghan army and police will be ready to take charge by 2014 to provide effective security is questionable. However, President Hamid Karzai argued otherwise.
At the end of the day, like every other nation, must provide for the sovereignty of the country.
During his talks with Wolff, Karzai thanked Germany, which he said had shown itself to be among Afghanistan's best friends. The Afghan president is due to come to Germany in early December for an international conference on the conflict in his country. It'll be the first time Karzai will lead such a gathering himself, and expectations are high for a way forward on how Afghanistan can stand on its own two feet by 2014. Darren Marra, Deutsche Welle Radio.
For more news and information from the heart of Europe, visit our website, dwworld.de. There you will find the latest news updates, as well as podcasts of many Deutsche Welle radio programs. With a uniquely European perspective on the events of the day, you're listening to Deutsche Welle Radio Newslink from Bonn, Germany.
They've accomplished what thousands of designers dream of, not only selling their merchandise worldwide, but building a cult following behind their brand. They're the Freitag brothers, based in Zurich, Switzerland. They've been selling messenger bags made from recycled vinyl signs back since they were students. Almost 20 years later, they tell Jenny Hoff the secret behind their brand's success.
When people are willing to chase down trucks to gather material for your next product, it might be a sign that you've developed a cult brand.
Our customers, or we call it, I like to call them brand friends, they probably feel that there has been some kind of drive in it from the beginning, which have been honest and true till now. So we have been following this track without going away from that basic idea.
Brothers Daniel and Marcus Freitag are reluctant to call themselves businessmen. Though they just opened their 8th Freitag store in New York and have 400 retailers worldwide selling their upscale messenger bags, the brothers say they don't feel much different than they did 18 years ago as students in Zurich. That's when they made their first Freitag bag out of sheer necessity. They simply needed a way to carry their books from home to class while riding their bikes.
We started to develop our own bike messenger bag made out of recycled truck tarps. The truck tarps came because of my living situation, which was next to the freeway. So the trucks have been inspiring us to use the old truck tarps as the material for our bags.
In the beginning, there was a belief there could be another way of making bags, that there was a belief that maybe you could reuse things which have been thrown away otherwise. And so this brought us to a certain way how we do our bags.
When the brothers tell their story, they start with their childhood, their love of inventing new ways of using old materials. And it's that same love of reinvention that helped them build a cult brand. Their bags are made from old tarpaulins, seatbelts, rubber tubing, and even used airbags. Their headquarters in Zurich is a tower made from out-of-service trucks that have been gutted and refitted to create an office space. Customers can also create their own customized bag on the Freitag website. As the brothers explained to a room full of brand managers, advertisers, and journalists at the Berlin School of Creative Leadership, building a cult brand means providing more than just a product for customers.
It's not about creating a product which hasn't been around, but providing maybe subconscious moments which give you a good feeling in the need of what you have a lack in life. And maybe it's the individualism that every bag is unique is much more important than the function of transporting something.
But the success hasn't come overnight. And though they could potentially grow much faster, the brothers say another secret to building a cult brand is to not sell out to shareholders.
Well, I think we have been growing from a student project into now we have the age of a teenager. Yeah, 18 years, so you start to grow up a bit. And I think this organically growing process is perfect for us. I think to be in control of your ideas and doing of what we do because we believe it's a good thing and not because we need to or because an investor tells us, and I think that's definitely the way of how we like to grow, that we go step by step.
But for now, those steps are still going up. As the brothers continue to build the Freitag brand, they're counting on their loyal legion of customers to not only keep an eye out for potential materials, but spread the word of the cult brand. In Berlin, Jenny Hoff, Deutsche Welle Radio.
For more news and information, do visit our website, dwworld.de. There you can find podcasts of this and many other Deutsche Welle radio programs with a uniquely European perspective on the events of the day. You're listening to Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio. My name is Matt Herman. You're listening to Deutsche Welle Radio's Newslink. I'm Matt Herman. Coming up on the next 30 minutes of Newslink, we'll pay a visit to Europe's premier meetup of artisanal dairy farmers, who are hoping that their numbers will swell.
I think that if you would reward farms like this with, well, either benefits or make it easier for people to start doing this kind of farming, then it will definitely have its effects on people that are striving to do this.
We'll have that story in a few minutes, but first, this Monday, representatives from the top 30 companies listed on Germany's stock exchange, those that make up the DAX index, committed themselves to raising the number of female executives in top positions. At present, their level of progress on that score had been pretty pathetic. Just 7 of 190 executive board members at those firms are women. The initiative was widely interpreted as a move to head off impending legislation to make them do it. From Berlin, Hardy Greppner has this report.
In March of this year, Germany's DAX-listed companies have promised to revisit earlier voluntary but rather unsuccessful commitments to increase the number of females in top management positions. On Monday, they finally presented the paper in which they reiterate their resolve to raise the percentage of female executives. The individual goals vary significantly, with companies eventually aiming for anything between 12 and 35% of women in top jobs. Harald Krüger is a staff manager at carmaker BMW. We've set up realistic and verifiable goals which take into consideration the specific structures and requirements in our companies, he said. We commit ourselves to publishing a progress report on an annual basis. This means that there will be full transparency as to how far we've come towards increasing the percentage of female executives. We view this procedure as being far better than introducing a specific law to this end. We believe there's no need for it anymore. The Minister for Family Affairs, Christina Schröder, sees the company's renewed voluntary commitment as a confirmation of her own convictions that no legislation is needed to introduce a female quota. The list that the companies have presented to us today is encouraging, as all companies are planning to hit double-digit targets when it comes to the percentage of female executives, she said. But Schröder's fellow Christian Democrat, Labour Minister Ursula von der Leyen, insists that the DAX company's move cannot be the final word on the matter and that a specific law is not off the table. She criticizes that no clear definition was provided for women in top positions and that posts on the board of directors or advisory boards were not included in the commitment. We are a modern country with a large number of highly educated and highly skilled women, she said. Given that, companies here can no longer just say that female executives are fine for some sub-departments, but let the male executives remain among themselves at the very top. The government announced on Monday that the Chancellery would invite for a special round of talks with DAX company representatives on the real top positions later this year. A recent count showed only 7 out of nearly 190 executive board members at Germany's top 30 companies are female. Hardy Graupner, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
From the boardroom now to the cockpit. Since the dawn of aviation, women pioneers have set world records and flown military missions. However, it's taken them much longer to break the gender barrier in the airline business. The percentage of female commercial pilots is still in the single digits, but efforts are underway to change that. Diana Fong has this report on German flag carrier Lufthansa's progress.
Einen schönen guten Tag, meine Damen und Herren aus dem Cockpit. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, from the flight deck. We just left our cruising altitude and will now start the approach into Berlin-Tegel. The remaining flight time, approximately 20 minutes.
That was First Officer Rieke Hurler speaking from the cockpit of the German airline Lufthansa, where 1 out of 20 pilots is a woman, an industry average.
Before start checklist.
Before start gear pins.
Removed.
Pitot-static.
Checked.
In the cockpit, however, gender discrimination is not an obstacle anymore, according to Captain Jörg Handwerk, spokesman for the German Airline Pilots Association.
We had a saying which said, if God meant women to fly, then he would have painted the sky pink and not blue. But nowadays, these days are long gone. Since the 80s, people got to their senses and said, yes, why shouldn't women be pilots?
Today, airlines complain they can't get enough women to even apply for the flight training programs they offer.
If you apply for the job, all the airlines are happy. But if you only have about 8% application rate, then you cannot have 50% women pilots.
That the application rate among women is so low is puzzling, especially since the annual starting salary of a young pilot at a major commercial airline such as Lufthansa is about 60,000 euros, or $82,000, more than that of a junior medical doctor or federal judge in Germany. One problem might be the lack of role models. First Officer Huller, now 25, was inspired by her father, who is also a pilot.
One reason I became a pilot because I think if my father wouldn't be a pilot, I would not have even thought about it. But the other thing is, I think there are too few female role models. In the movies and in the TV, it's always the male heroes who are flying the airplanes.
Okay, we got the Brane 2 November departure. Starts at 600 feet, direct Romeo Whiskey on ADF.
For a younger generation of women, the technical demands of the job or sexism are no longer the main issue. What does matter is whether a company offers family-friendly policies that make it easier for women to combine work with motherhood. Lufthansa spokesman Michael Lamberti explains.
The job of a pilot, it's not Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, but it's planable. And if you decide only to continue your career on a part-time level, you can choose between several schemes, for instance, to reduce the number of flight time at 50% or so, to find your solution within your family context to have a good work-life balance. There is no reason at all not to try it, and there is no reason at all that you can't combine it with being a mother.
German labour laws already guarantee protections for pregnant pilots and flight crew, as well as paid maternity leaves. A woman who takes time off or reduces her flying hours to care for children does not lose seniority either and can keep up her skills in a flight simulator. But a pilot career has its drawbacks too. It could mean being thousands of miles away from home at a five-day stretch.
I mean, for every mother, it's hard to leave their small children. What I found was very hard for me and very hard for my kids, and I heard it from colleagues as well, is the standby regulations. Because you are reading a book with the kids or cooking or playing with them, and suddenly the phone rings and mommy goes off.
That was Martina Stickle-Posner, who was once a flight attendant but is now a labour lawyer representing pilots. She says that the airlines don't always encourage part-time work, since it costs more to train and maintain two part-time pilots on the payroll than just one full-time one.
There are airlines who say, OK, we can't afford to have more part-time workers than we have today because pilot education is so very expensive.
The irony is, when the industry is in a slump, the airlines are happy to reduce the workload of pilots.
Landing, all green, flaps full.
All green, flaps full.
The airline industry is always one of the first to be impacted by the state of the global economy, in good times and bad. But in a volatile industry, one steady trend is emerging. The proportion of female pilots is slowly but surely rising. Among Lufthansa's current crop of trainees, some 15% are women compared to the 6% who have already earned their wings. 300. Diana Fong, Deutsche Welle Radio.
40, 30, 20, retard.
Perspectives on the news, a uniquely European point of view. Newslink here on Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Matt Herman. A peace conference has been taking place in Spain's Basque region this Monday, with noted peacemakers Bertie Ahern and Kofi Annan among those participating. The event seeks to prepare the path to peace in a region that has long seen a campaign of violence by separatists. But in Spain, there's unease and even anger that this conference is taking place at all. Guy Hedgecoe tells us why.
The northern Spanish city of San Sebastian saw an array of international public figures visit on Monday. Former United Nations Secretary-General Kofi Annan and Gerry Adams of Irish Republican Party Sinn Féin were among those present, as was former Irish Prime Minister Bertie Ahern. The occasion was an international meeting to promote peace in the Basque region, an event Desmond Tutu's Peace Foundation helped organise. The separatists of ETA have waged a four-decade campaign of violence against the Spanish state in their bid for an independent Basque homeland, killing over 800 people in the process. Now, expectations are high that the group will disband, and this conference has sought to encourage that process and ensure a lasting peace. Local Basque politicians were also present at the event, but the conference has been attacked by others, particularly in Madrid, who see it as meddling in a Spanish issue. Esteban González Ponce is a spokesman for the opposition Popular Party, which chose not to attend the conference. He said in no uncertain terms that the event was inappropriate. Foreigners who go to a peace conference in the Basque Country thinking that they're in Ireland or South Africa frankly don't have a damned idea about what country they're in. Peace conferences take place in conflicts where there are two sides at war. ETA has been severely weakened over the last decade, with Spanish and French police arresting many of its leaders and seizing its weapons. The group unilaterally ended a 2006 ceasefire by bombing Madrid airport and killing two people, a move that many believe ended any hopes ETA may have had of negotiating with the government in the future. In recent months, ETA's political support has publicly pressured the group to renounce violence. It hasn't killed since announcing a new truce a year ago, and occasionally makes announcements such as this one, expressing its desire for a peaceful resolution to the Basque issue. But while ETA's full demise has repeatedly been forecast, it still exists. The premier of the Basque country, the socialist Patxi López, also expressed doubts about the conference, and no representatives of his local government or the socialist central government attended. However, he called on ETA to see it as an opportunity to disband. If ETA and those around them need this to bring about their end, then they should take advantage of it fully to bring the curtain down. Most critics of the conference think it gives ETA a degree of credibility and international attention that it doesn't deserve, thus making real peace more difficult to achieve. With both of Spain's two main parties sceptical of these international peace efforts, and with a general election on November 20th, the ETA issue is often the focus of heated campaign debate. Cayo Lara of the United Left Coalition berated the Socialists and Popular Party for their stance on this issue. If the conference helps to make sure ETA disappears forever and that terrorism in Spain becomes just a black page in our history, then we should welcome it. There have been rumours that ETA could announce its disbandment in the next few days. If it does so, the San Sebastian Peace Conference is unlikely to get much of the credit. Guy Hedgeco, Deutsche Welle Radio, Madrid.
The French have voted in their first ever presidential election primary. They've elected François Hollande to be the Socialist Party's challenger to incumbent President Nicolas Sarkozy next May. Hollande took 57% of the vote and beat his second round rival Martine Aubry by a wide margin. As John Lawrenson reports from Paris, voters chose the most centrist candidate on offer.
It was the clash of two visions of the left, one personified in the figure of Martine Aubry, who, as employment minister under President Mitterrand, created what has perhaps been modern French socialism's most iconic reform, the 35-hour maximum working week. Against her, a man she dubbed in one of the primary's few moments of heat and agitation as the leader of the soft left, la gauche molle. It sounds very much worse in French, with a very strong connotation of flaccidity. But soft or not, left-wing voters see in Hollande their best chance of beating Nicolas Sarkozy, because with the ex-IMF president Dominique Strauss-Kahn out of the running, Hollande is seen as the safest pair of hands when it comes to the economy. He made much of the importance of bringing down France's national debt and did not promise to turn back Sarkozy's retirement pension reform. Nevertheless, he is promising to renew the link between the French people and the principles of the French Revolution by raising taxes and spending the money on 60,000 new jobs in education.
Offrir à la jeunesse de France, à la génération qui vient, une vie meilleure que la nôtre.
We must offer to the youth of France, to the coming generation, the prospect of lives which are better than ours, said Hollande. It's the French dream that we have to conjure up again, the dream which enabled generation after generation throughout the history of the French Republic to believe in equality and progress, which is why I have made education the great priority of what could be my 5-year term of office.
De ce qui pourra être demain mon prochain quinquennat.
With his spectacles and his Mr. Average brushover, François Hollande does not exactly sparkle with star quality. During the last presidential election, he was assigned the rather inglorious role of Mr. Ségolène Royal, as he was at the time most famous for being the companion, as they put it here, of the glamorous-looking, though wooden-sounding, presidential candidate of the day. He's a parliamentarian very much implanted in his native Corrèze, a rural rugby-playing département at the gate to southwest France. Indeed, he is a candidate of the country rather than the city, the provinces rather than the capital. If you look at the map of Sunday's voting, there are a few places where Hollande did badly, but the big one is Paris. Political commentator Eric Zemmour says Nicolas Sarkozy would have preferred Aubry as an opponent. He would have enjoyed setting up a comparison between what he would have described as a modern forward-looking right with an archaic left. But, says Zemmour, Sarkozy's advisers will have already chosen their line of attack against Hollande.
Avec Hollande, ce sera l'inexpérience. Hollande n'a jamais été ministre, même pas le plus petit Marocain.
With Hollande, it's going to be his inexperience, Zemmour told RTL Radio. Hollande has never been a minister, never held even the tiniest ministerial portfolio. He's a local politician, king of a party of local politicians. It's the small and medium-sized towns of France that gave Hollande his victory over the candidate of the big cities. In the midst of the Euro storm, Sarkozy will play the role of the weather-hardened professional against the provincial amateur.
Contre le provincial amateur.
But Sarkozy will have to tread carefully. Hollande managed to stay nice during his fight with Aubry. She was the one calling him names, not the other way round. There are many, many people in France who dislike the metropolitan elite, and many more who dislike the pit bull aggression of the current French head of state. The last and only time in modern French history that the people chose a socialist president, he had an election poster showing a peaceful French village, and the slogan was Quiet Strength, La Force Tranquille. Hollande may be very much harder to beat than he looks. John Lawrenson, Deutsche Welle Radio, Paris.
To Latvian politics now, where the newly elected parliamentarians are struggling to form a ruling coalition. A month has passed since the general election took place, which was called by the then-incumbent president, Valdis Satlers, in a bid to oust the oligarchs from the parliament. That target was achieved, but the parties are close to stalemate after a difficult round of coalition talks. From Riga, Gerrit Skelsis reports.
About 2,000 angry people, mainly from the Russian minority, gathered in front of the parliament building in Riga this morning to protest against the decision to leave the pro-Russian party alliance, the Harmony Center, in the opposition once again. The party has 31 seats in the 100-seat parliament and it was very close to being in the government for the first time. But even as the coalition talks broke down, many protesters were still hoping that the Harmony Center would still end up in the new government.
Miss.
We, Latvians and Russians, are living as friends here in Latvia. But it's the politicians who are trying to divide us.
Problem with ethnics and between Latvian and Russians, actually it's not the main problem. The main problem for me is corruption, then this capitalism and this corporate stuff. You know, for me it's evil.
The new parliamentarians gathered for their first plenary session today, but there is still only a vague idea about who will run the country for the next 3 years. To start with, the Unity Party of Prime Minister Valdis Dombrovskis refused to enter a coalition with the pro-Russian party. So the Reform Party of former President Valdis Satlers agreed to a three-way coalition with a nationalist party instead. But on Sunday, the Trinity was suddenly undermined by a split in the Reform Party. Six deputies decided to launch their own group, accusing their party of lacking internal democracy. That leaves the coalition with just 50 votes, not enough to be effective. Valdi Zatler, the leader of the party, described it as a painful betrayal.
That was an unpleasant surprise from a political point of view, because our new party was established to improve the political culture in Latvia. But this breakaway group reminds me of a case when a number of Latvian deputies decided to join an oligarch's party some years ago. And I believe that there are unknown forces behind these six politicians who decided to leave the Reform Party.
Political analysts say that everything depends on whether the six deputies will support the new cabinet led by the incumbent Prime Minister Valdis Dombrovskis. The political scientist Jānis Ikstens thinks everything is up for grabs in the new coalition, but he thinks it's unlikely that Dombrovskis will want to involve the Harmony Center.
The Harmony Center didn't see Euro coming in 2014. They did not care very much about the budget deficit. They wanted to have an immediate increase of old age pensions. All these little bits and pieces may have finally prompted to drop the Harmony Center as a potential coalition partner at this point.
Before the new cabinet can be approved, the president of Latvia, Andris Bērziņš, has to name the next prime minister. And it is very likely that he will name the experienced Valdis Dombrovskis to run the government for a third successive term, as the deadline for implementing new austerity measures in 2012 is approaching fast. Jadars Ģeozes, Deutsche Welle Radio, Riga.
Around the world, around the clock. News and perspectives from the heart of Europe on DWTV, Deutsche Welle Radio, and online at dwworld.de. From Bonn, Germany, you're listening to Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster.
Here's a statistic for you. Only 7% of farmers in Europe are under 35 years old. It's an unsurprising figure given the difficulties that small-scale farmers face when they try and compete against industrial farms. Large-scale dairy farms are a particularly tough adversary for artisanal cheese producers, but there are still some young people who believe in the traditional methods of the past and want to prove that sustainable, organic farming is possible. Every 2 years, the international movement Slow Food holds its Cheese Convention, a platform for cheesemakers from all over the world to familiarize people with their products, get to know each other, and create support networks. It's also an amazing place to eat cheese. And so, tasting toothpick at the ready, Danny Mitzman went along and filed this report.
Cristina Guzmeroli is just 17 years old. For the past 2 years, she's been helping her family make a traditional cheese of the Lombardy region called Bitto.
I've always loved animals, especially cows, and I've always loved going up into the mountains. I used to sell cheese with my grandmother, and then whenever I could, I'd race up to join my dad to look after the cows. Even when it rained, my granny couldn't stop me. Then, in 2009, I had the chance to learn to make cheese, and I liked it straight away.
The cheese Cristina's family makes is a rare alpine cheese that's made while the milk is still warm from the cows. As it has to be transformed immediately, the cheesemakers live up in tiny mountain cabins all summer and have special tents which serve as makeshift dairies. 3 months camping in alpine pastures and getting up at 4 or 5 a.m. might sound arduous, but Cristina loves it.
I'd like to continue. I've wanted to carry on my father's business ever since I was a little girl, but only time will tell if I can make my dream come true.
Listening to Cristina talk about her hopes for the future is another young cheesemaker, Manuel Lombardi. His family have been making a rare cheese named Conciato Romano for generations and are the only people in Castel di Sasso who do so commercially, according to EU hygiene and marketing standards. Stored in a terracotta amphora with olive oil, chili pepper and wild thyme, Conciato Romano is one of the oldest cheeses in Italy, first made by the Samnites before the Romans. 34-year-old Manuel is desperate for other young people to rediscover the tradition before his beloved sheep's milk cheese disappears.
E mi sono emozionato sentendo parlare persone che avevano addirittura una ragazza che è Cristina.
I was very moved to hear people like Cristina, who's just 17 and has made such an important choice. It's not often that you share something like this with other young people. You usually end up having to talk about other stuff, football, models, that kind of thing. But when you find young people like this who share your perspective, it makes you hope that other young people will wake up, because we need them. We have abandoned mountains and land. They say there's no work, there's a recession, but there is work, if you're willing to make sacrifices.
Manuel says it's understandable that young people are afraid the sacrifices will outweigh the benefits. Producing a maximum of 700 kilos of cheese a year, his family only survives thanks to extra income from their farmhouse bed and breakfast. They get no institutional funding, and he'd like to see more EU support for small farmers and cheesemakers.
I think that if you would reward farms like this with, well, either benefits or, well, make it easier for people to start doing this kind of farming, then it will definitely have its effects on people that are striving to do this or willing to do this. They will want to get in that more.
Jan Nolano is the head of Slow Food's International Youth Food Movement. He's campaigning to get the new 2013 Common Agricultural Policy, or CAP, to reflect these needs.
And it's now very difficult, because what the CAP is really favouring at the moment is large-scale production. And this is just something that should stop, really, because we have enough large-scale production. What we need is innovative solutions, and this comes from the people that stand with their feet in the mud.
But Janno believes it's not all the fault of the policymakers and industrial farms, nor the responsibility of the small farmers to fight alone. He'd like European society to see the bigger picture.
What you need is like a very conscious group of consumers that's really involved in the way how their food is produced, and also, yeah, legislation that is encouraging, for example, more biodiversity. So what we're really trying to do is make this policy as it is now less about economics and more about common sense, if you will. So eat what is produced by the season in your local region. So this means sometimes that people will have to change their habits.
And it can be done. One group of consumers who've already changed their habits are the people of the valley where Cristina Gusmeroli produces her cheese. Paolo Ciapparelli, the president of the Bito Cheese Association, last year created the Consortium for the Preservation of Historic Bito, inviting locals to finance its production.
There are people who understand that we need to defend certain products. If we want to leave our children a healthy and environmentally, historically and culturally important heritage, we have to do it as best we can. And it's not easy because it goes against everything we've been taught. Without the numbers, you can't do anything.
Paolo says the investment's already paying off. 45 out of the 73 people who now work with him to make this Alpine cheese are under the age of 40.
Tutti si chiedono come fa la produzione.
People ask how such an old tradition involving hand milking, etc., can have so many young people involved. The only way to help young people and promote continuity is to pay them what's right and give them satisfaction. So those people who ask me why, the reason is we pay our people well. We have given the job its value back.
Paolo Ciapparelli, who believes united microeconomies are the future, hopes his community's example will give other European cheesemakers the courage to continue. Danny Mitzman, Deutsche Welle Radio, Bra.
That's all for this edition of Newslink. I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you tune in again tomorrow. I'm Matt Herman. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.